they tried to trick you into doing at school, where you could argue your case. As if that was a way of concluding a discussion, checking who knew more long words. Uwe wanted what was right to be right and what was wrong to be wrong. He knew very well that some people thought he was nothing but a grumpy old sod without any faith in people. But, to put it bluntly, that was because other people had never given him reason to see it another way. Because a time comes in all men's lives when they decide what sort of men they're going to be, the kind that lets other people walk all over them, or not. Uwe slept in the Saab the nights after the fire. The first morning he tried to clear up among the ashes and destruction. The second morning, he had to accept that this would never sort itself out. The house was lost, and all the work he had put into it. On the third morning, two men wearing the same kind of white shirt as that chief fireman turned up. They stood by his gate, apparently quite unmoved by the ruin in front of them. They didn't present themselves by name, only mentioned the name of the authority they came from, as if they were robots sent out by the mothership. "We've been sending you letters," said one of the white shirts, holding out a pile of documents for Uwe. "Many letters," said the other white shirt and made a note in a pad. "You never answered," said the first, as if he was reprimanding a dog. Uwe just stood there, defiant. "Very unfortunate, this," said the other with a curt nod at what used to be Uwe's house. Uwe nodded. "The fire brigade says it was caused by a harmless electrical fault," continued the first white shirt, robotically, pointing at a paper in his hand. Uwe felt a spontaneous objection to his use of the word harmless. "We've sent you letters," the second man repeated, waving his pad. "The municipal boundaries are being redrawn. The land where your house stands will be developed for a number of new constructions."
"The land where your house stood," corrected his partner.
"The council is willing to purchase your land at the market price," said the first man.
"Well, a market price now that there's no longer a house on the land," clarified the other.
Uwe took the papers, started reading.
"You don't have much of a choice," said the first. "This is not so much your choice as the council's," said the other.
The first man tapped his pen impatiently against the papers, pointing at a line at the bottom where it said, "Signature." Uwe stood at his gate and read their document in silence. He became aware of an ache in his breast. It took a long, long time before he understood what it was. Hate. He hated those men in white shirts. He couldn't remember having hated anyone before, but now it was like a ball of fire inside. Uwe's parents had bought this house. Uwe had grown up here, learned to walk. His father had taught him everything there was to know about a Saab engineer. And after all that, someone at a municipal authority decided something else should be built here. And a man with a round face sold insurance that was not insurance. A man in a white shirt prevented Uwe from putting out a fire, and now two other white shirts stood here talking about a market price. But Uwe really did not have a choice. He could have stood there until the sun had completely risen, but he could not change the situation. So he signed their document, while keeping his fist clenched in his pocket. He left the plot where once his parental home had stood, and he never looked back. Rented a little room from an old lady in town. Sat and stared desolately at the wall all day. In the evening he went to work, cleaned the train compartments. In the morning he and the other workers were told not to go to their usual changing rooms. They had to go back to the head office to pick up new sets of work clothes. As Uwe was walking down the corridor, he met Tom. It was the first time they had seen each other since Uwe got blamed for the theft from the carriage. A more sensible man than Tom would probably have avoided eye contact or tried to pretend that the incident had never happened. But Tom was not a more sensible sort of man.
"Well, if it isn't the little thief," he exclaimed with a combative smile.
Uwe didn't answer. Tried to get past, but got a hard elbow from one of the younger colleagues Tom surrounded himself with. Uwe looked up. The younger colleague was smiling disdainfully at him.
"Hold on to your wallets, the thief's here,"
Tom called out so loud that his voice echoed through the corridors. With one hand, Uwe took a firmer grip on the pile of clothes in his arm, but he clenched his fist in his pocket, went into an empty changing room, took off his dirty old work clothes, unclipped his father's dented wristwatch and put it on the bench. When he turned round to go into the shower, Tom was standing in the doorway.
"We heard about the fire," he said.
Uwe could see that Tom was hoping he'd answer.
"That father of yours would have been proud of you. Not even he was useless enough to burn down his own bloody house,"
Tom called out to him as he was stepping into the shower. Uwe heard his younger colleagues all laughing together. He closed his eyes, leaned his forehead against the wall and let the hot water flow over him. Stood there for more than 20 minutes, the longest shower he'd ever had. When he came out, his father's watch was gone. Uwe rooted among the clothes on the bench, searched the floor, fine-combed all the lockers. A time comes in all men's lives when they decide what sort of men they're going to be, whether they're the kind that let other people tread on them or not. Maybe it was because Tom had put the blame on him for the theft in the carriage. Maybe it was the fire. Maybe it was the bogus insurance agent, or the white shirts. Or maybe it was just enough now. There and then, it was as if someone had removed a fuse in Uwe's mind. Everything in his eyes grew a shade darker. He walked out of the changing room, still naked and with water dripping from his flexing muscles. Walked to the bottom of the corridor to the foreman's changing room, kicked the door open and cleared a way through the astonished press of men inside. Tom was standing in front of a mirror at the far end, trimming his bushy beard. Uwe gripped him by the shoulder and roared so loudly that the sheet metal-covered walls echoed, "Give me back my watch!" Tom, with a superior expression, looked down at his face. His dark figure towered over Uwe like a shadow. "I don't have your give it here!" Uwe bellowed before Tom had reached the end of the sentence, so fiercely that the other men in the room saw fit to move a little closer to their lockers. A second later, Tom's jacket had been ripped out of his hands with such power that he didn't even think of protesting. He just stood there, like a punished child, as Uwe hauled out his wristwatch from the inside pocket. And then Uwe hit him. Just once. It was enough. Tom collapsed like a sack of wet flour. By the time the heavy body hit the floor, Uwe had already turned around and walked away. A time like that comes for all men, when they choose what sort of men they want to be. And if you don't know the story, you don't know the men. Tom was taken to the hospital. Again and again he was asked what had happened, but Tom's eyes just flickered, and he mumbled something about having slipped. And strangely enough, none of the other men who'd been in the changing rooms at the time had any recollection of what had happened. That was the last time Uwe saw Tom, and he decided the last time he'd let anyone trick him. He kept his job as a night cleaner, but he gave up his job at the construction site. He no longer had a house to build, and anyway he'd learned so much about construction by this point that the men in their hard hats no longer had anything to teach him. They gave him a toolbox as a farewell present, this time with new-bought tools. "To the puppy, to help you build something that lasts," they'd written on a piece of paper. Uwe had no immediate use for it, so he carried it about aimlessly for a few days. Finally, the old lady renting him a room took pity on him and started looking for things round the house for him to mend. It was more peaceful that way for both of them. Later that year, he enlisted for military service. He scored the highest possible mark for every physical test. The recruitment officer liked this taciturn young man who seemed as strong as a bear, and he pressed him to consider a career as a professional soldier. Uwe thought it sounded good. Military personnel wore uniforms and followed orders. All knew what they were doing. All had a function. Things had a place. Uwe felt he could actually be good as a soldier. In fact, as he went down the stairs to have his obligatory medical examination, he felt lighter in his heart than he had for many years. As if he'd been given a sudden purpose, a goal. Something to be. His joy lasted no more than 10 minutes. The recruitment officer had said that the medical examination was a mere formality. But when the stethoscope was held against Uwe's chest, something was heard that should not have been heard. He was sent to a doctor in the city. A week later, he was informed that he had a rare congenital heart condition. He was exempted from any further military service. Uwe called and protested. He wrote letters. He went to 3 other doctors in the hope that a mistake had been made. It was no use.
"Rules are rules," said a white-shirted man in the army's administrative offices the last time Uwe went there to try to overturn the decision.
Uwe was so disappointed that he did not even wait for the bus. Instead, he walked all the way back to the train station. He sat on the platform, more despondent than at any time since his father's death. A few months later, he would walk down that platform with the woman he was destined to marry. But at that precise moment, of course, he had no idea of this. He went back to his work as a night cleaner on the railways, grew quieter than ever. The old lady whose room he rented eventually grew so tired of his gloomy face that she arranged for him to borrow a nearby garage. After all, the boy had that car he was always fiddling with, she said. Maybe he could keep himself entertained with all that. Uwe took his entire Saab to pieces in the garage the next morning. He cleaned all the parts and then put them together again, to see if he could do it, and to have something to do. When he was done with it, he sold the Saab at a profit and bought a newer but otherwise identical Saab 93. The first thing he did was to take it to pieces, to see if he could manage it, and he could. His days passed like this, slow and methodical. And then one morning he saw her. She had brown hair and blue eyes and red shoes and a big yellow clasp in her hair. And then there was no more peace and quiet for Uwe. Chapter 13. A Man Called Uwe and a Clown Called Beppo.
"Uwe's funny,"
titters the 3-year-old with delight.
"Yeah,"
the 7-year-old mumbles, not at all as impressed. She takes her little sister by the hand and walks with grown-up steps towards the hospital entrance. Their mother looks as if she's going to have a go at Uwe, but seems to decide that there's no time for that. She waddles off towards the entrance, one hand on her pouting belly, as if concerned that the child may try to escape. Uwe walks behind, dragging his steps. He doesn't care that she thinks it's easier just to pay up and stop arguing. Because it's actually about the principal. Why is that parking attendant entitled to give Uwe a ticket for questioning why one has to pay for hospital parking? Uwe is not the sort of man who will stop himself from roaring, "You're just a fake policeman," at a parking attendant. That's all there is to say about it. You go to hospital to die. Uwe knows that. It's enough that the state wants to be paid for everything you do while you're alive. When it also wants to be paid for the parking when you go to die, Uwe thinks that's about far enough. He explained this in so many words to the parking attendant, and that's when the parking attendant started waving his book at him. And that's when Pavana started raging about how she'd be quite happy to pay up, as if that was the important part of the discussion. Women don't seem to get principles. He hears the 7-year-old complaining in front of him that her clothes are smelling of exhaust. Even though they kept the Saab's windows rolled down all the way, it wasn't possible to get rid of the stench. Their mother had asked Uwe what he'd really been doing in there in the garage, but Uwe had just answered with a sound more or less like when you try to move a bathtub by dragging it across some tiles. Of course, for the 3-year-old, it was the greatest adventure of her life to be able to drive along in a car with all its windows down, although it was below zero outside. The 7-year-old, on the other hand, had burrowed her face into her scarf and vented a good deal more scepticism. She'd been irritated about slipping around with her bottom on the sheets of newspaper Uwe had spread across the seat to stop them filthifying things. Uwe had also spread newspaper on the front seat, but her mother snatched it away before she sat down. Uwe had looked more than advisably displeased about this, but managed not to say anything. Instead, he continuously glanced at her stomach all the way to the hospital, as if anxious that she might suddenly start leaking over the upholstery. "Stand still here now," she says to the girls when they're in the hospital reception. They're surrounded by glass walls and benches smelling of disinfectant. There are nurses in white clothes and colourful plastic slippers, and old people dragging themselves back and forth in the corridors, leaning on rickety walkers. On the floor is a sign announcing that Lift 2 in Entrance A is out of order, and that visitors to Ward 114 are therefore asked to go to Lift 1 in Entrance C. Beneath that is another message announcing that Lift 1 in Entrance C is out of order, and visitors to Ward 114 are asked to go to Lift 2 in Entrance A. Under that message is a third message, announcing that Ward 114 is closed this month because of repairs. Under that message is a picture of a clown, informing people that Beppo, the hospital clown, is visiting sick children today. "Where did Uwe get to now?" Bhavana bursts out.
"He went to the toilet, I think,"
mumbles the 7-year-old.
"Clown!" says the 3-year-old, pointing happily at the sign.
"Do you know? You have to pay them here to go to the toilet,"
Uwe exclaims incredulously. Bhavana spins round and gives Uwe a harassed look. "Do you need change?" Uwe looks offended.
"Why would I need change?"
"For the toilet?"
"I don't need to go to the toilet."
"But you said..." She begins, then stops herself and shakes her head. "Forget it. Just forget it. When does the parking ticket run out?" she asks instead.
10 minutes.
She groans.
"Don't you understand? It'll take longer than 10 minutes. In that case, I'll go out and feed the meter in 10 minutes, says Uwe, as if this was quite obvious.
"Why don't you just pay for longer and save yourself the bother?" she asks, and looks like she wishes she hadn't as soon as the question crosses her lips.
"Because that's exactly what they want. They're not getting a load of money for time we might not even use."
"Oh, I don't have the strength for this," sighs Bhavana, and holds her forehead. She looks at her daughters. "Will you sit here nicely with Uncle Uwe while Mum goes to see how Dad is? Please?"
"Yeah, yeah,"
nods the 7-year-old, grumpily.
"Yes!"
the 3-year-old shrieks with excitement.
"What?"
whispers Uwe. Bhavana stands up.
"What do you mean, with Uwe? Where do you think you're going?"
To his great consternation, the pregnant one seems not to register the level of upset in his voice. "You have to sit here and keep an eye on them," she states curtly, and disappears down the corridor before Uwe can raise further objections. Uwe stands there staring at her, as if he was expecting her to come rushing back and crying out that she was only joking. But she doesn't. So Uwe turns to the girls. And in the next second he looks as if he's just about to shine a desk lamp into their eyes and interrogate them on their whereabouts at the time of the murder.
"Book!"
screams the 3-year-old at once and rushes off towards the corner of the waiting room, where there's a veritable chaos of toys, games and picture books. Uwe nods, and having confirmed to himself that this 3-year-old seems to be reasonably self-motivating, he turns his attention to the 7-year-old.
"Right. And what about you?"
"What do you mean, me?"
she counters with indignation.
"Do you need food, or do you have to go for a wee, or anything like that?"
The child looks at him as if he just offered her a beer and a cigarette.
"I'm almost 8. I can go to the toilet myself."
Uwe throws out his arms abruptly.
"Sure, sure, so bloody sorry for asking."
she snorts.
"You swored!"
yells the 3-year-old as she turns up again, running to and fro between Uwe's trouser legs. He sceptically peruses this grammatically challenged little natural disaster. She looks up and her whole face smiles at him.
"Read!"
she orders him in an excitable manner, holding up a book with her arms stretched out so far that she almost loses her balance. Uwe looks at the book more or less as if it just sent him a chain letter insisting that the book was really a Nigerian prince who had a very lucrative investment opportunity for Uwe and now only needed Uwe's account number to sort something out.
"Read!"
she demands again, climbing the bench in the waiting room with surprising agility. Uwe reluctantly sits about a meter away on the bench. The 3-year-old sighs impatiently and disappears from sight, her head reappearing seconds later under his arm, with her hands leaning against his knee for support and her nose pressed against the colourful pictures in the book.
"Once upon a time there was a little train," reads Uwe, with all the enthusiasm of someone reciting a tax statement.
Then he turns the page. The 3-year-old stops him and goes back. The 7-year-old shakes her head, tiredly.
"You have to say what happens on that page as well, and do voices," she says.
Uwe stares at her. "What bl—" He clears his throat mid-sentence. "What voices?" he corrects himself.
"Fairy tale voices,"
replies the 7-year-old.
"You swore,"
the 3-year-old announces with glee. "Did not," says Uwe.
"Yes,"
says the 3-year-old. "We're not doing any blub—" "We're not doing any voices."
"Maybe you're no good at reading stories,"
notes the 7-year-old. "Maybe you're no good at listening to them," Uwe counters.
"Maybe you're no good at telling them."
Uwe looks at the book, very unimpressed. "What kind of nonsense is this anyway? Some talking train, is there nothing about cars?"
"Maybe there's something about nutty old men instead,"
mutters the 7-year-old.
"I'm not an old man," Uwe hisses.
"Clown!"
the 3-year-old cries out jubilantly. "And I'm not a clown either," he roars. The older one rolls her eyes at Uwe, not unlike the way her mother often rolls her eyes at Uwe.
"She doesn't mean you. She means the clown."
Uwe looks up and catches sight of a full-grown man who's quite seriously got himself dressed up as a clown, standing in the doorway of the waiting room. He's got a big stupid grin on his face as well.
"Clown!"
the toddler howls, jumping up and down on the bench in a way that finally convinces Uwe that the kid is on drugs. He's heard about that sort of thing. They have that attention deficit hyperactivity disorder and get to take amphetamines on prescription.
"And who's this little girl here, then? Does she want to see a magic trick, perhaps?"
the clown exclaims helpfully and squelches over to them like a drunken moose in a pair of large red shoes that Uwe confirms to himself only an utterly meaningless person would prefer to wear rather than getting himself a proper job. The clown looks gaily at Uwe.
"Has Uncle got a 5-crown piece, perhaps?"
"No, Uncle doesn't, perhaps," Uwe replies.
The clown looks surprised, which isn't an entirely successful look for a clown.
"But, listen, it's a magic trick. You do have a coin on you, don't you?"
mumbles the clown in his more normal voice, which contrasts quite strongly with his character and reveals that behind this idiotic clown, a quite ordinary idiot is hiding, probably all of 25 years old.
"Come on, I'm a hospital clown. It's for the children's sake. I'll give it back." "Just give him a 5-crown coin," says the 7-year-old.
"Clown!" screams the 3-year-old. Uwe peers down with exasperation at the tiny speech defect and wrinkles his nose. "Right," he says, taking out a 5-crown piece from his wallet. Then he points at the clown.
"But I want it back, immediately. I'm paying for the parking with that."
The clown nods eagerly and snatches the coin out of his hand. Minutes later, Pavani comes back down the corridor to the waiting room. She stops, confusedly scanning the room from side to side.
"Are you looking for your girls?" a nurse asks, sharply behind her.
"Yes," Pavani answers, perplexed.
"There," says the nurse in a not entirely appreciative way and points at a bench by the large glass doors leading onto the parking area.
Uwe is sitting there with his arms crossed, looking very angry. On one side of him sits the 7-year-old, staring up at the ceiling with an utterly bored expression, and on the other side sits the 3-year-old, looking as if she's just found out she's going to have an ice cream breakfast every day for a whole month. On either side of the bench stand 2 particularly large representatives of the hospital's security guards, both with very grim facial expressions.
"Are these your children?"
one of them asks. He doesn't look at all as if he's having an ice cream breakfast.
"Yes. What did they do?" Pavana wonders, almost terrified.
"They didn't do anything," the other security guard replies with a hostile stare at Uwe.
"Me neither,"
Uwe mutters sulkily.
Hoover hit the clown, the three-year-old shrieks delightedly.
Sneak, says Hoover. Pavana stares at him, agape, and can't even think of anything to say.
He was no good at magic anyway, the seven-year-old groans. Can we go home now? She asks, standing up.
Why? Hold on. What clown?
The clown? Beppo,
the toddler explains, nodding wisely.
He was going to do magic, says her sister.
Rubbish magic, says Uwe.
Like, he was going to make Uwe's 5-crown coin go away,
the 7-year-old elaborates. And then he tried to give back another 5-crown coin, Uwe interjects, with an insulted stare at the nearby security guards, as if this should be enough of an explanation.
Uwe hit the clown, Mum, the 3-year-old titters, as if this was the best thing that ever happened in her whole life.
Pavana stares for a long time at Uwe, the 3-year-old, 7-year-old, and the 2 security guards.
We're here to visit my husband. He's had an accident. I'm bringing in the children now to say hello to him, she explains to the guards.
Daddy fall, says the 3-year-old.
That's fine, nods one of the security guards. But this one stays here, confirms the other security guard and points at Uwe.
I hardly hit him. I just gave him a little poke, Uwe mumbles, adding, bloody fake policeman, just to be on the safe side.
Honestly, he was no good at magic anyway, says the 7-year-old grumpily in Uwe's defence as they leave to visit their father.
An hour later, they're back at Uwe's garage. The lanky one has one arm and one leg in plaster and has to stay at the hospital for several days, Uwe has been informed by Pavana. When she told him, Uwe had to bite his lip very hard to stop himself laughing. He actually got the feeling Pavana was doing the same thing. The Saab still smells of exhaust when he collects the sheets of newspaper from the seats.
Please, Uwe, are you sure you won't let me pay the parking fine? Says Pavana.
Is it your car? Uwe grunts.
No.
Well then, he replies.
But it feels a bit like it was my fault, she repeats, concerned.
You don't hand out parking fines, the council does, so it's the bloody council's fault, says Uwe, and closes the door of the Saab. And those fake policemen at the hospital, he adds, clearly still very upset, that they forced him to sit without moving on that bench until Pavana came back to pick him up and they went home. As if he couldn't be trusted to wander about freely among the other hospital visitors.
Pavana looks at him for a long time in thoughtful silence. The 7-year-old gets tired of waiting and starts walking across the parking area towards the house. The 3-year-old looks at Uwe with a radiant smile.
You're funny,
she smiles. Uwe looks at her and puts his hands in his trouser pockets.
You shouldn't turn out too bad yourself.
The 3-year-old nods excitedly. Pavana looks at Uwe. Looks at the plastic tube on the floor of his garage. Looks at Uwe again, a touch worried.
I could do with a bit of help, taking the ladder away, she says, as if she was in the middle of a much longer thought.
Uwe kicks distractedly at the asphalt.
And I think we have a radiator as well that doesn't work, she adds, a passing thought.
Would be nice of you if you could have a look at it. Patrick doesn't know how to do things like that, you know. She says and takes the 3-year-old by the hand.
Uwe nods slowly.
No.
Might have known.
Pavana nods. Then she suddenly gives off a satisfied smile.
And you can't let the girls freeze to death tonight, Uwe, right? It's quite enough that they had to watch you assault a clown, no?
Uwe gives her a dour glance. Silently, to himself, as if negotiating. He concedes that he can hardly let the children perish just because their no-good father can't open a window without falling off a ladder. There'd be a hellish amount of nagging from Uwe's wife if he went and arrived in the next world as a newly qualified child murderer. Then he picks up the plastic tube from the floor and hangs it up on a hook on the wall. Locks the Saab with the key, closes the garage, tugs at it 3 times to make sure it's closed, then goes to fetch his tools from the shed.
Tomorrow's as good a day as any to kill oneself. Chapter 14. A man who was Uwe and a woman on a train. She had a golden brooch pinned to her front, in which the sunlight reflected hypnotically through the train window. It was 6:30 in the morning. Uwe had just clocked off his shift and was actually supposed to be taking the train home. But then he saw her on the platform, with all her rich auburn hair and her blue eyes and all her effervescent laughter. And he got back on the train. Of course, he didn't quite know himself why he was doing it. He had never been spontaneous before in his life. But when he saw her, it was as if something malfunctioned. He convinced one of the conductors to lend him his spare pair of trousers and shirt, so he didn't have to look like a train cleaner, and then Uwe went to sit by Sonia. It was the single best decision he would ever make. He didn't know what he was going to say, but he had hardly had time to sink into the seat before she turned to him cheerfully, smiled warmly, and said, "Hello." And he found he was able to say, "Hello," back to her without any significant complications. And when she saw that he was looking at the pile of books she had in her lap, she tilted them slightly so he could read their titles. Uwe only understood about half the words. "You like reading?" she asked him brightly. Uwe shook his head with some insecurity, but it didn't seem to concern her very much. She just smiled, said that she loved books more than anything, and started telling him excitedly what each of the ones in her lap was about. And Uwe realized that he wanted to hear her talking about the things she loved for the rest of his life. He had never heard anything quite as amazing as that voice. She talked as if she was continuously on the verge of breaking into giggles. And when she giggled, she sounded the way Uwe imagined champagne bubbles would have sounded if they were capable of laughter. He didn't quite know what he should say to avoid seeming uneducated and stupid, but it proved to be less of a problem than he had thought. She liked talking, and Uwe liked keeping quiet. Retrospectively, Uwe assumed that was what people meant when they said that people were compatible. Many years later, she told him that she had found him quite puzzling when he came to sit with her in that compartment. Abrupt and blunt in his whole being. But his shoulders were broad and his arms so muscular that they stretched the fabric of his shirt. And he had kind eyes. He listened when she talked, and she liked making him smile. Anyway, the journey to school was so boring that it was pleasant just to have some company. She was studying to be a teacher, came on the train every day. After 10 or 20 kilometres, she changed to another train, then a bus. All in all, it was a 1.5-hour journey in the wrong direction for Uwe. Only when they crossed the platform that first time, side by side, and stood by her bus stop, did she ask what he was doing there. And when Uwe realized that he was only 5 or so kilometres from the military barracks where he would have been had it not been for that problem with his heart, the words slipped out of him before he understood why. "I'm doing my military service over there," he said, waving vaguely. "So maybe we'll see each other on the train going back as well. I go home at 5. Uwe couldn't think of anything to say. He knew, of course, that one does not go home from military installations at 5 o'clock, but she clearly did not. So he just shrugged. And then she got on her bus and was gone. Uwe decided that this was undoubtedly very impractical in many ways, but there was not a lot to be done about it. So he turned round, found a signpost, pointing out the way to the little centre of the tiny student town where he now found himself, at least a 2-hour journey from his home. And then he started walking. After 45 minutes, he asked his way to the only tailor in the area, and after eventually finding it, ponderously stepped inside to ask whether it would be possible to have a shirt ironed and a pair of trousers pressed, and if so, how long it would take.
10 minutes, if you wait," came his answer.
"Then I'll be back at 4, said Uwe, and left. He wandered back down to the train station and lay down on a bench in the waiting hall. At 3:15, he went all the way back to the tailor's, had his shirt and trousers pressed, while he sat waiting in his underwear in the staff toilet, then walked back to the station and took the train back with her for 1.5 hours back to her station. and then travelled for another half hour to his own station. He repeated the whole thing the day after, and the day after that. On the following day, the man from the cash desk at the train station intervened and made it clear to Uwe that he couldn't sleep here like some loafer. Surely he could understand that. Uwe saw the point he was making, but explained that there was a woman at stake here. When he heard this, the man from the ticket desk gave him a little nod, and from then on let him sleep in the left luggage room. Even men at train station ticket desks have been in love. Uwe did the same thing every day for 3 months. In the end, she grew tired of his never inviting her out for dinner, so she invited herself instead. "I'll be waiting here tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock. I want you to be wearing a suit, and I'd like you to invite me out for dinner," she said succinctly as she stepped off the train one Friday evening. And so it was. Uwe had never been asked how he lived before he met her, but if anyone had asked him, he would have answered that he didn't. On the Saturday evening, he put on his father's old brown suit. It was tight round his shoulders. Then he ate 2 sausages and 7 potatoes, which he prepared in the little kitchenette in his room, before doing his rounds of the house to put in a couple of screws, which the old lady had asked him to do. "Are you meeting someone?" she asked, pleased to see him coming down the stairs. She had never seen him wearing a suit. Uwe nodded gruffly. "Yeah," he said, in a way that could either be described as a word or an inhalation. The older woman nodded and probably tried to hide a little smile. "It must be someone very special if you've dressed yourself up like that," she said. Uwe inhaled again and nodded curtly. When he was at the door, she called out from the kitchen, "Flowers, Uwe." Perplexed, Uwe stuck his head round the partition wall and stared at her. "She'd probably like some flowers," the old woman declared with some emphasis. Uwe cleared his throat and closed the front door. For more than 15 minutes he stood waiting for her at the station in his tight-fitting suit and his new polished shoes. He was sceptical about people who came late. "If you can't depend on someone being on time, you shouldn't trust them with anything more important either," he used to mutter when people came dribbling along with their clocking-in cards 3 or 4 minutes late, as if this didn't matter. As if the railway line would just lie there waiting for them in the morning and not have something better to do. So for each of those 15 minutes that Uwe stood waiting at the station, he was slightly irritated. And then the irritation turned into a certain anxiety, and after that he decided that Sonia had only been ribbing him when she suggested they should meet. He had never felt so silly in his entire life. Of course she didn't want to go out with him. How could he have got that into his head? His humiliation when the insight dawned on him welled up like a stream of lava, and he was tempted to toss the flowers in the nearest bin and march off without turning round. Looking back, he couldn't quite explain why he stayed. Maybe because he felt, in spite of it all, that an agreement to meet was an agreement. And maybe there was some other reason. Something a little harder to put your finger on. He didn't know it at that moment, of course, but he was destined to spend so many quarter hours of his life waiting for her that his old father would have gone cross-eyed if he'd found out. And when she did finally turn up, in a long floral print skirt and a cardigan so red that it made Uwe shift his body weight from his right foot to his left, he decided that maybe her inability to be on time was not the most important thing. The woman at the florist's had asked him what he wanted. He informed her gruffly that this was a bit of a bloody question to ask. After all, she was the one who sold the greens, and he the one who bought them, not the other way round. The woman had looked a bit bothered about that, but then she asked if the recipient of the flowers had some favourite colour, perhaps. "Pink," Uwe had said with great certainty, although he did not know. And now she stood outside the station with his flowers pressed happily to her breast, in all that red cardigan of hers, making the rest of the world look as if it was made in grayscale. "They're absolutely beautiful," she smiled, in that candid way that made Uwe stare down at the ground and kick at the gravel. Uwe wasn't much for restaurants. He had never understood why one would ever eat out for a lot of money when one could eat at home. He wasn't so taken with show-off furniture and elaborate cooking, and he was very much aware of his conversational shortcomings as well. Whatever the case, he had at least eaten in advance, so he could afford to let her order whatever she wanted from the menu, while opting for the cheapest dish for himself. And at least if she asked him something, he wouldn't have his mouth full of food. To him, it seemed like a good plan. While she was ordering, the waiter smiled ingratiatingly. Uwe knew all too well what both he and the other diners in the restaurant had thought when they came in. She was too good for Uwe. That's what they'd thought. And Uwe felt very silly about that, mostly because he entirely agreed with their opinion. She told him with great animation about her studies, about books she'd read or films she'd seen, and when she looked at Uwe, she made him feel for the first time that he was the only man in the world. And Uwe had enough integrity to realize that this wasn't right. He couldn't sit here lying any longer. So he cleared his throat, collected his faculties, and told her the whole truth. That he wasn't doing his military service at all. That in fact he was just a simple cleaner on the trains, who had a defective heart, and who had lied for no other reason than that he enjoyed riding with her on the train so very much. He assumed this would be the only dinner he ever had with her, and he did not think she deserved having it with a fraudster. When he had finished his story, he put his napkin on the table and got out his wallet to pay. "I'm sorry," he mumbled, shamefaced, and kicked his chair leg a little, before adding in such a low voice that it could hardly even be heard. "I just wanted to know what it felt like to be someone you look at." As he was getting up, she reached across the table and put her hand on his. "I've never heard you say so many words before," she smiled. He mumbled something about how this didn't change the facts. He was a liar. When she asked him to sit down again, he obliged her and sank back into his chair. She wasn't angry the way he thought she'd be. She started laughing. In the end, she said it hadn't actually been so difficult working out that he wasn't doing his military service because he never wore a uniform. "Anyway, everyone knows soldiers don't go home at 5 o'clock on weekdays." Uwe had hardly been as discreet as a Russian spy, she added. She'd come to the conclusion that he had his reasons for it. And she'd liked the way he listened to her and made her laugh, and that, she said, had been more than enough for her. And then she asked him what he really wanted to do with his life, if he could choose anything he wanted. And then he answered, without even thinking about it, that he wanted to build houses, construct them, draw the plans, calculate the best way to make them stand where they stood. And then she didn't start laughing as he thought she would. She got angry. "But why don't you do it then?" she demanded to know. Uwe did not have a particularly good answer to that one. On the Monday, she came to his house with brochures for a correspondence course leading to an engineering qualification. The old landlady was quite overwhelmed when she looked at the beautiful young woman walking up the stairs with self-confident steps. Later, she tapped Uwe's back and whispered that those flowers were probably a very good investment. Uwe couldn't help but agree. When he came up to his room, she was sitting on his bed. Uwe stood sulkily in the doorway with his hands in his pockets. She looked at him and laughed. "Are we an item now?" she asked. "Well, yes," he replied hesitantly. "I suppose it could be that way." And then it was that way. She handed him the brochures. It was a 2-year course, and it proved that all the time Uwe had spent on learning about house building had not, after all, been wasted, as he once believed. Maybe he did not have much of a head for studying in a conventional sense, but he understood numbers, and he understood houses. That got him far. He took the examination after 6 months, then another, and another. Then he got his employment at the housing office and stayed there for more than a third of a century. Worked hard, was never ill, paid his mortgage, paid tax, did his duty. Bought a little 2-story terraced house in a recently constructed development in the forest. She wanted to get married, so Uwe proposed. She wanted children, which was fine with him, said Uwe. And their understanding was that children should live in terraced housing developments among other children. And less than 40 years later there was no forest round the house anymore, just other houses. And one day she was lying there in a hospital, and holding his hand and telling him not to worry, everything was going to be all right. Easy for her to say, thought Uwe, his breast pulsating with anger and sorrow. But she just whispered, "Everything will be fine, darling Uwe," and leaned her arm against his arm, and then gently pushed her index finger into the palm of his hand, and then closed her eyes and died. Uwe stayed there with her hand in his for several hours, until the hospital staff entered the room with warm voices and careful movements, explaining that they had to take her body away. Uwe rose from his chair, nodded, and went to the undertakers to take care of the documentation. On the Sunday she was buried. On the Monday he went to work. But if anyone had asked, he would have told them that he never lived before he met her, and not after either. Chapter 15. A Man Called Uwe and a Delayed Train. The slightly porky man on the other side of the plexiglass has back-combed hair and arms covered in tattoos. As if it isn't enough to look like someone has slapped a pack of margarine over his head, he has to cover himself in doodles as well. There's not even a proper motif as far as Uwe can see, just a lot of patterns. Is that something an adult person in a healthy state of mind would consent to? Going about with his arms looking like a pair of pyjamas? "Your ticket machine doesn't work," Uwe informs him.
"No?"
says the man behind the plexiglass.
"What do you mean, no?"
"I mean, I'm asking. Doesn't it work?"
"I just told you it's broken."
The man behind the plexiglass looks dubious.
"Maybe there's something wrong with your card. Some dirt on the magnetic strip," he suggests.
Uwe looks as if the man behind the plexiglass had just raised the possibility of Uwe having erectile dysfunction. The man behind the plexiglass goes silent.
"There's no dirt on my magnetic strip, you can be sure of that," Uwe splutters.
The man behind the plexiglass nods, then changes his mind and shakes his head. Tries to explain to Uwe that the machine actually worked earlier in the day. Uwe dismisses this as utterly irrelevant, of course, because it is clearly broken now. The man behind the plexiglass wonders if Uwe has cash instead. Uwe replies that this is none of his bloody business. A tense silence settles. At long last, the man behind the plexiglass asks if he can check out the card. Uwe looks at him as if they just met in a dark alley and he's asked to check out Uwe's private parts.
"Don't try anything," Uwe warns as he hesitantly pushes it under the window.
The man behind the plexiglass grabs the card and rubs it against his leg in a vigorous manner. As if Uwe had never read in the newspaper about that thing they call skimming, as if Uwe was an idiot.
"What are you doing?"
Uwe cries and bangs the palm of his hand against the plexiglass window. The man pushes the card back under the window.
"Try now," he says.
Uwe thinks that any old fool could figure out that if the card wasn't working half a minute ago, it isn't going to work now either. Uwe points this out to the man behind the plexiglass.
"Please," says the man.
Uwe sighs demonstratively, gets out his card again, without taking his eyes off the plexiglass. The card works.
"You see," jeers the man behind the plexiglass.
Uwe glares at the card, as if he feels it has double-crossed him before he puts it back in his wallet.
"Have a good day,"
the man behind the plexiglass calls out behind him. "We'll see," mutters Uwe. For the last 20 years, practically every human being he's met has done nothing but drone on at Uwe about how he should be paying for everything by card. But cash has always been good enough for Uwe. Cash has, in fact, served humanity perfectly well for thousands of years. And Uwe doesn't trust the banks and all their electronics. But his wife insisted on getting hold of one of those cards in spite of it all, even though Uwe warned her against it. And when she died, the bank simply sent Uwe a new card in his name, connected to her account. And now, after he's been buying flowers for her grave for the past 6 months, there's a sum of 136 crowns and 54 ure left on it. And Uwe knows very well that this money will disappear into the pocket of some bank director if Uwe dies without spending it first. But now, when Uwe actually wants to use that damned plastic card, it doesn't work, of course, or there are a lot of extra fees when he uses it in the shops, which only goes to prove that Uwe was right all along, and is going to say as much to his wife as soon as he sees her. She had better be quite clear about that. He had gone out this morning, long before the sun had drummed up the energy to rise over the horizon, much less any of his neighbours. He had carefully studied the train timetable in the hall. Then he turned out the lights, switched off the radiators, locked his front door, and left the envelope with all the instructions on the hall mat inside the door. He assumed that someone would find it when they came to take the house. He fetched the snow shovel, cleared the snow away from the front of the house, put back the shovel in the shed, locked the shed. Had Uwe been a bit more attentive, he would have noticed the fairly large cat-shaped cavity in the quite large snowdrift just outside his shed as he started heading off towards the parking area. But because he had more important things on his mind, he did not. Chastened by recent experiences, he did not take the Saab, but walked, instead, to the station. Because this time neither pregnant foreign women, blonde weeds, Runa's wife, nor low-quality rope would be given any opportunity of ruining Uwe's morning. He'd bled these people's radiators, loaned them his things, given them lifts to the hospital, but now he was finally on his way. He checked the train timetable once more. He hated being late. It ruined the planning, made everything out of step. His wife had been utterly useless at it, keeping to plans, but it was always like that with women. They couldn't stick to a plan even if you glued them to it, Uwe had learned. When he was driving somewhere, he drew up schedules and plans and decided where they'd fill up and when they'd stop for coffee, all in the interest of making the trip as time-efficient as possible. He studied maps and estimated exactly how long each leg of the journey would take and how they should avoid rush-hour traffic and the shortcuts to take that people with sat-navs wouldn't be able to make head nor tail of. Uwe always had a clear travel strategy. His wife, on the other hand, always came up with insanities like going by a sense of feel and taking it easy, as if that was a way for an adult person to get anywhere in life. And then she always remembered that she had to make a call or had forgotten some scarf or other, or she didn't know which coat to pack at the last moment, or something else. She always forgot the thermos of coffee on the draining board, which was actually the only important thing. There were four coats in those damn bags, but no coffee. As if one could just turn off into a petrol station every hour and buy the burnt fox piss they were selling in there, and get even more delayed. And when Uwe got disgruntled, she always had to challenge the importance of having a time plan when driving somewhere. "We're not in a hurry anyway," she'd say, as if that had anything to do with it. Now, standing at the station platform, he presses his hands into his pockets. He isn't wearing his suit jacket. It's much too stained and smells too strongly of car exhaust, so he feels she'd probably have a crack at him if he were to turn up in that. She doesn't like the shirt and jumper he's wearing now, but at least they're clean and in a decent condition. It's almost 15 degrees below zero. He hasn't yet changed the blue autumn jacket for the blue winter coat, and the cold is blowing straight through it. He's been a bit distracted of late, he has to admit. He hasn't given any real thought to how one is supposed to present oneself when arriving upstairs. Initially, he thought one should be all spruced up and formal. Most likely there'll be some kind of uniform up there to avoid confusion. He supposes there will be all sorts of people, foreigners, for instance, each one wearing stranger kit than the next. Presumably, it will be possible to organise your clothes once you get there. Surely there will even be some sort of wardrobe department. The platform is almost empty. On the other side of the track are some sleepy-looking youths with oversized backpacks, which Uwe decides are most likely filled with drugs. Alongside them is a man in his 40s in a grey suit and a black overcoat. He's reading the newspaper. A little further off are some small talking women in their best years, with county council logos on their chests and purple tresses of hair. They're chain-smoking long menthol cigarettes. On Uwe's side of the track it's empty, but for three over-dimensioned municipal employees in their mid-30s in workman's trousers and hard hats, standing in a ring and staring down into a hole. Around them is a carelessly erected loop of cordon tape. One of them has a mug of coffee from 7-Eleven, another is eating a banana, the third is trying to poke his mobile without removing his gloves. It's not going so well. And the hole stays where it is. And still we're surprised when the whole world comes crashing down in a financial crisis, Uwe thinks, when people do little more than standing around eating bananas and looking into holes in the ground all day. He checks his watch. 1 minute left. He stands at the edge of the platform, balancing the soles of his shoes over the edge. It's a fall of no more than 1.5 meters, he estimates, 160 possibly. There's a certain symbolism in a train taking his life, and he doesn't like this much. He doesn't think the train driver should have to see the awfulness of it. For this reason, he has decided to jump when the train is very close, so it's the side of the first carriage that throws him onto the rails, rather than the big windscreen at the front. He looks in the direction the train is coming from, and slowly starts counting. It's important that the timing is absolutely right, he determines. The sun is just up. It shines obstinately into his eyes like a child who has just been given a torch. And that's when he hears the first scream. Uwe looks up just in time to see the suit-wearing man in his black overcoat starting to sway back and forth like a panda that's been given a Valium overdose. It continues for a second or so, then the suit-wearing man looks up blindly and his whole body is struck with some form of nervous twitching. His arms shake convulsively, and then, as if the moment is a long sequence of still photographs, the newspaper falls out of his hands and he passes out, falling off the edge, onto the track with a thump, as if he were a crate of cement mixture. The chain-smoking old girls with the county council logos on their breasts start shrieking in panic. The drug-taking youths stare at the track, their hands enmeshed in their backpack straps, as if fearing that they might otherwise fall over. Uwe stands on the edge of the platform on the other side and looks with irritation from one to the other. For Christ's sake, fumes Uwe to himself at long last as he jumps down onto the track. Grab hold here, will you? He calls out to one of the backpackers on the platform. The stultified youth drags himself slowly to the edge. Uwe hoists up the suit-wearing man in a way that men who have never put their foot in a gym yet have spent their entire lives carrying 2 concrete plinths under each arm tend to be able to do. He heaves up the body into the backpacker's arms in a way that Audi-driving men wearing neon-bright jogging pants are often incapable of doing. "He can't stay here in the path of the train, you get that, don't you?" The backpackers nod in confusion, and finally, by their collective efforts, manage to drag the suit-wearing body onto the platform. The county council women are still screaming, as if they sincerely believe this is a constructive approach under the circumstances. The man appears to be breathing, but Uwe stays down there on the track. He hears the train coming. It's not quite the way he planned it, but it'll have to do. Then he calmly goes into the middle of the track, puts his hands in his pocket, and stares into the headlights. He hears the warning whistle like a foghorn, feels the track shaking powerfully under his feet, as if a testosterone-fueled bull were trying to charge him. He breathes out. In the midst of that inferno of shaking and yelling and the chilling scream of the train's brakes, he feels a deep relief. At last. To Uwe, the moments that follow are elongated as if time itself has applied its brakes and made everything around him travel in slow motion. The explosion of sounds is muted into a low hiss in his ears, the train approaching so slowly that it's as if it's being pulled along by 2 decrepit oxen. The headlights flash despairingly at him, and in the interval between 2 of the flashes, while he isn't blinded, he finds himself establishing eye contact with the train driver. He can't be more than 20 years old, one of those who still gets called the puppy by his older colleagues.
Hoover stares into the puppy's face, clenches his fists in his pockets, as if he's cursing himself for what he's about to do. But it can't be helped, he thinks. There's a right way of doing things, and a wrong way. So the train is perhaps about 15 meters away when Hoover swears with irritation, and as calmly as if he was getting up to fetch himself a cup of coffee, steps out of the way and jumps up on the platform again. The train has drawn level with him by the time the driver has managed to stop it. The puppy's terror has sucked all the blood out of his face. He is clearly holding back his tears. The two men look at each other through the locomotive window, as if they had just emerged from some apocalyptic desert and now realized that neither of them were the last human beings on Earth. One is relieved by this insight, and the other disappointed. The boy in the locomotive nods carefully. Hoover nods back with resignation. Fair enough that Hoover no longer wants his life, but the sort of man who ruins someone else's by making eye contact with him seconds before his body is turned into blood paste against the said person's windscreen. Damn it! Hoover is not that sort of man. Neither his dad nor Sonia would ever have forgiven him for that.
Are you all right?
One of the hard hats calls out behind Hoover.
Another minute and you'd have been a goner,
yells one of the others. They stand there staring at him, not at all unlike the way they were standing just now and staring into that hole. It seems to be their prime area of competence, in fact, to stare at.